This is Larry Levitt from KaiserNetwork.org. Welcome to Elements of State Health Reform, a partnership with the National Governors Association. These interactive web shows look at the growing momentum for health reform in the states and probe the key issues populations are facing as they develop approaches to cover the uninsured and make healthcare more affordable. Today, we're looking at steps states have taken to improve the quality and transparency of healthcare and how they're building quality improvement strategies into their health reform plans and Medicaid programs. There's a broad consensus among experts around a variety of measures to improve quality and reduce medical errors in the health system. And in some cases, there's a compelling case that efforts to improve quality can also reduce costs. But in spite of this apparent consensus, getting these measures implemented has continued to prove challenging. We're joined by a panel of experts who have been in the trenches of the quality movement, working to design initiatives, build consensus, and implement programs. Melanie Bella is Senior Vice President at the Center for Healthcare Strategies, working to improve care for people with chronic illnesses and disabilities. She previously served as the Medicaid Director in Indiana, where she developed a chronic disease management program for Medicaid beneficiaries. Doug Wood is Vice Chair of the Department of Internal Medicine and a practicing cardiologist at the Mayo Clinic. He's been a driving force behind the Acute Care Quality and Pay for Performance Initiative in Minnesota, where he's joining us by phone. Peggy O'Kane is the longstanding president of the National Committee on Quality Assurance. Under her leadership, NCQA has become the recognized leader in accrediting health plans and measuring the quality of health care they deliver. And Helen Burstyn is the Senior Vice President for Performance Measures at the National Quality Forum, which was created in 1999 to improve the measurement of quality and foster system-wide improvement. You can ask questions of the panel at any time during the show by sending an email to ask@kaisernetwork.org. And thanks to all of you for joining us. And Helen, let me start with you. Let's begin by sort of diagnosing the problem here. Where do you see the gaps in quality in the current system?
The unfortunate thing is the gaps are fairly everywhere. I think if you looked overall at the current status of healthcare quality, you would see that it's not in only defined areas, but fairly general landscape of healthcare quality where we're falling short. And there's been multiple studies, including Beth McGlynn's study, which people often quote about a 55% chance of getting quality healthcare, the indicated services that you should get for your given condition. The national reports out of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality continue to demonstrate that we're really falling short on quality, minimal improvements over time, and it's clear that we need some sort of systematic approach to measurement and improvement.
And where are some of the specific areas, let's say, in hospitals or in doctors' offices where we see the effects of that?
Almost every chronic condition you can imagine, and I think it's especially true for chronic care because that's really where you need to see the care coordination, the teamwork. The current system is so inefficient and so fraught with the inability of one side of a healthcare team to know what the other side of a healthcare team is doing, that it becomes very frustrating. So certainly we know, for example, that probably about one-fifth of all hospital admissions may be unnecessary, about one-seventh of every laboratory test is probably unnecessary. And much of that really is the sense that the right hand doesn't know what the left hand's doing. You've ordered that test. A specific diagnostic study has been done but not been followed up on. That's the kind of thing that I think is fairly ubiquitous and most striking for those with chronic illness because they keep coming back to the healthcare system for ongoing care. And that's really where we see it failing.
And would you say, I mean, you talked about people getting care they may not need. I mean, what about also not getting care they may need?
Yeah, it's, you know, the quality issue we have right now is the combination of both underuse. There are certain populations, particularly when you think about issues of disparities, where we continue to see populations not getting the care they should get. And then we have a significant problem with overuse as well, where care is often delivered that's inappropriate or is being delivered because no one knows that, in fact, the test has already been done. And then you could also argue there's a fair problem with misuse, meaning we actually still see a fair amount of medical errors and systems issues that create misuse of care as well.
And what if, I mean, you and others have put together lists of best practices that hospitals, that physicians should comply with. I mean, give us a sense of what some of those best practices look like.
Sure. Probably one of the best examples is a recent update the National Quality Forum just did to our Safe Practices document. Just came out fairly recently. And what it does is it very systematically goes through the key things that hospitals should be doing to maintain, at least on the safety side. I think the other thing, which we'll probably hear a lot more from Peggy in a moment about, is that you can't improve what you don't measure. And I think increasingly the way to really drive this is the more we systematically measure healthcare quality in the same way, and that's part of the issue too. We both have too many quality measures and too few quality measures. And what we really need to have is a prioritized set of what are the most important conditions, what are the most important measures, and have all of us begin regularly monitoring them, getting them in real time so it can actually be used both for accountability, things like pay for performance, but even more so, being able to use it in real time to drive improvement at the clinical setting. So I think the idea of having both a set of practices that hospitals and other healthcare settings, this is certainly not unique to hospitals by any means, can begin to follow. But secondly, really thinking about what's that core set of measures all of us should be measuring in a similar way so that we can begin to try to make sense of where we're falling short. And then I would also argue, see where we're falling short of populations as well, so we can begin to get at issues of disparities.
Well, Peggy, let's turn to measurement. You've been doing this for a long
17
time.
17 years.
and you know, in the beginning, a lot of these measures were process-oriented measures because that's all we could measure. And over time, they've moved more in the direction of measuring outcomes, which I think most would agree is the right approach. I mean, give a sense of the state of the art now. I mean, what...
Well, I think, you know, process measures definitely have their place as long as we're measuring processes that are tightly linked to outcomes. And, I mean, there are many reasons, like small numbers, that we wind up focusing on the process measures. But they're also very actionable and really kind of teach-ins at the same time that they reveal what's going on. So I think we need to be thinking about population-based outcomes and functional status and so forth as we move forward, but we also have to stay with, I think it's a mix, actually. It's a mix of how the patients are doing, how often the processes were right, and, you know, other things like that.
And how would you characterize the kind of where we stand in terms of the technology of measurement? I mean, are we close to getting it right? Is it just constantly?
No, I think we are at the end of the beginning. I think we've mapped primary care quite well. I think primary care doctors will tell you that we're measuring a lot of the things that they do. But now the whole world of specialty care is very, very complex. There are many overlapping specialties, and there are actually gaps in the evidence. So as we move, I mean, we started, as you know, measuring health plans, and then we also have some programs at the doctor level. But I think we need a framework for accountability. You know, kind of a, if you think about the word supply chain, which is used in industry, that's the way we need to frame it in healthcare. So.
And do you think we need to be measuring both at the health plan and the
absolutely, all the way up and down the system. Mm-hmm. And that's where Helen's point about you don't want to have dueling measures at different levels of the system. So there needs to be a lot of alignment.
And who do you see as the main audience for measures? I mean, is it purchasers? Is it consumers?
I think it's everybody. I think the providers themselves, doctors and hospitals, are very, very eager consumers of the measures. Consumers are, not every consumer, though, is going to be in a position to look. You're not in a discretionary care scenario many times. You know, often you're going to the hospital in an ambulance, so you don't get to choose. So I think we need to have things that people can look at in a discretionary situation, but we need to use measures much more broadly. And regulators, obviously the states themselves, have many ways in which they use measures.
And you said you've been doing this for 17 years. What kind of trends have you seen, not so much in the actual technology of the measurement, but in the actual measures themselves? I mean, is there a trend upwards?
Well, I can tell you how we started out, I mean, just to be parochial, I guess, but we started with preventive services. And everybody said, oh, yawn, that's very boring. Everybody does preventive services. I mean, it's been really very interesting because I think over and over again we've been surprised by the results. So this is really kind of a journey in which we're constantly having to change our paradigm and learn from what we've revealed. And I keep thinking of it as we can't drive beyond the headlights, and the headlights don't really take us that far. So we have to be constantly in this learning and reflective mode at the same time that we're trying to move this agenda forward.
And when you started out, I mean, it wasn't the case that everyone was getting preventive care?
No. I mean, I think everyone was appalled when they first saw the results. And I think it's, I mean, whatever we're measuring, the first round is always shocking. And so, I mean, it just goes to show you that quality doesn't happen by accident. It takes a lot of determination and really, really a lot of planning and very careful execution against the plan.
And Doug Wood, let me bring you in here from Minnesota. you've been the driving force behind this QCARE initiative there, and if you could just begin by describing what this program is.
Well, QCARE is now an acronym for Quality Care and Rewarding Excellence, but it actually started out as an effort to try to link measurement with improvement in practice and in outcome. It was a group that was chartered by Governor Pawlenty, but it incorporates physicians, hospital leaders, members of the legislature, both houses, business, and others. And what we've been trying to do in Minnesota is to link some significant resources that we have. We've had the Institute for Clinical Systems Improvement, which has tried to drive practice improvement across Minnesota since 1993, and we have also a measurement activity that is embodied by the Minnesota Community Measurement Project, which has been funded by the health plans. And so it gave us a great opportunity to try to address some of the gaps that both Helen and Peggy have talked about. And in particular, the goal is to try to get to a point where everybody understands first what we're trying to do for the care of these conditions based on science and guidelines. So that gets back to Helen's concern about how could we increase the percentage of patients who, in fact, receive effective care. And the ultimate goal is to make sure that payers in the context of business or the state and patients and physicians are all working from the same page. So we all know what we want to accomplish, we all know what the measures are going to be, and we can all use the same measures to our advantage. So that is, in a nutshell, what we're trying to accomplish with QCARE.
And do you, I mean, what's the point of leverage here? I mean, once you identify what the appropriate care is, the appropriate guidelines, and assess whether people are getting that, how do you change the system and bring the two together?
Well, the immediate point of leverage ultimately is at payment. So the Smart Buy Alliance of Minnesota, which is a combination of large and some medium-sized employers, as well as the state of Minnesota, in buying for its own employees as well as for its beneficiaries, are saying somewhere by 2010, we would like to see the performance of clinics and systems taking care of these people, that is, our employees and our beneficiaries, able to perform at a high level. And we've set some specific targets that we would like practices to achieve in order to be able to take care of these groups of patients.
And how would you assess where the state of your knowledge? I mean, do you feel confident that you do know what works, and that you're able to, you have enough tools to look at the system and see what kind of care people are getting?
We think we're pretty fortunate in Minnesota because of the resources that I mentioned earlier, and most of our providers actually are already participating in both of these efforts. So we're in my view anyway, pretty close to being able to do this in a very effective way. There are some gaps still. I think Helen's observations about gaps become very important. So one of our challenges actually is to then think about what is the next level of intervention and how can we get providers and patients in particular to make the right decisions. And I can illustrate that with the example of diabetes. So what we are trying to do now is to say that if you're a diabetic patient in Minnesota, you should get optimal care as defined by receiving every one of five specific things or achieving one of five specific outcomes. Now, in that, blood pressure control is one of the measures, adequacy of blood pressure control. And we know from the Community Measurement Project that only about half of our diabetic patients right now have adequate blood pressure control. Now, that gives us a great advantage because we now know what the number is, and we can go back to both doctors and physicians and say, or doctors and patients, and say, this is really where we need to concentrate our effort. And one of the challenges we have right now is inherent in this concept of optimal performance, that is doing everything, we sometimes focus on the wrong thing. So everybody's kind of concerned about the fact that about 20% of patients in Minnesota or people in Minnesota continue to smoke. And the concern has been, well, we'll never get them to stop. And it's a little bit surprising that we get focused on that and we then lose sight of the fact that blood pressure control is very actionable and its performance is actually worse than how we're doing with smoking.
And you asked, you mentioned payment as being the point of leverage. How is that framed? I mean, is it a carrot or a stick? I mean, do you, if you're a high performing provider, do you get a bonus, or if you're a low performing doctor, do you get dinged, or both?
There are two levels. One is the Smart Buy Alliance actually has implemented Bridges to Excellence, so there is a carrot that way. But ultimately, the expectation is that you wouldn't even qualify to take care of patients if you didn't meet a certain minimum level of performance.
Which is a hefty stick, certainly.
It is.
Well, I'm going to turn to Medicaid, which is perhaps the most direct point of leverage that states have in improving quality. And Melanie Bell, you ran a Medicaid program in Indiana and implemented a program of disease management for people with chronic illnesses. Describe the genesis of that program and what it's accomplishing.
Well, the genesis of the program really was based on the recognition that short-term financial fixes weren't going to cut it in Medicaid. And after having gone through trying to cut provider reimbursement and tweak services and tweak rates, it was clear that those things were not making a dent in what was really driving the cost of Medicaid. And to really get control of that meant going after the misuse, overuse, and underuse of services and really trying to improve the health status of the beneficiaries, particularly those with the greatest needs. And so with a lot of partners in Indiana, we put together a program focusing on congestive heart failure, diabetes, and asthma. And the program has started to demonstrate results, obviously. I've been away from it for a couple years, but it has a fairly rigorous evaluation that includes a randomized controlled trial and showing success. Particularly, though, I think the key element for Medicaid is really focusing on the high-cost, high-opportunity, if you will, patients. So diabetes costs more money in the short term, and that's what you'd expect. Congestive heart failure, one of the most high-risk areas, showed savings that more than made up for the cost of the total program. And so the work that we see going on in states today, where states are demonstrating tremendous leadership and really using the lever to improve quality improvement, has to do with trying to figure out how to have short-term and long-term quality improvement strategies so that they can get some short-term cost savings to try to fund the longer-term investments in quality that are really going to be the thing that makes the difference. So, for example, states launching high-risk asthma and high-risk prenatal OB programs, and they're able to demonstrate results in a quick enough period of time that allows them to make investments in better managing the care of their comorbid patients or the folks that are eligible for Medicaid and Medicare. Very smart strategies going on across the nation to try to recognize that it's not realistic to expect an immediate short-term gain, but that there are things they can do on a parallel track to really drive quality improvement across the system, not just within Medicaid.
And you talked about, if I heard you correctly, talked about short-term cost savings as well as long-term investments and long-term quality improvement. So was the experience that you could both lower costs and improve quality simultaneously? I mean, are they complementary, or are there cases where they're not?
Well, you hope they're complementary. I will say in the Indiana program, it certainly was taking longer to show any movement on the outcome side, which is, you know, again, to be expected. Some Medicaid programs are finding that they're able to see improvement in outcome based on patient-related measures, more so than changing provider behavior yet. But I think those things are building, and I think part of the challenge in Medicaid is aligning the measures with the intervention and getting smart about trying to understand what point in the system are they going to impact and measuring accordingly. For Medicaid, though, I mean, some real leadership is going on in management of the highest risk populations, and these are very complex populations with incredible special needs, multiple chronic conditions. They don't fit within the current measurement system. And so understanding that the greatest benefit that Medicaid is providing to these beneficiaries is care coordination and a managed system, and there aren't good measures for care coordination and comorbidities. And so you see some real leadership in states like Wisconsin that have adopted the Agency for Health Care Quality and Research Prevention Quality Indicators, mechanisms states are trying to use as proxies for care coordination and to understand at transition points where is care falling down. And it's great to hear these two experts next to me talking about the areas where they see opportunity going forward, because from our perspective, Medicaid offers the greatest platform for testing that due to the complexity of the population and the ability to leverage such purchasing power.
And what was, I mean, speaking of leverage, what was the leverage in the programming? Was it payments to providers, as Doug Wood was talking about? Was it direct management, case management of people's care?
In the Indiana program?
In Indiana, yeah.
The Indiana program was a bundled intervention, so it's hard to tease out. There was phone interaction, home-based interaction, provider collaboratives. We adopted Ed Wagner's chronic care model and did statewide provider collaboratives, and required that every patient had a self-management goal or several. And so I think that the lesson is you need several factors all coming together in a coordinated, managed way where someone is accountable for looking at both healthcare outcomes and cost. And getting away from the unmanaged systems in Medicaid is where we really need to see things moving.
And was this, did this operate through a private contractor or a private plan or multiple private plans? How did the contracting process work?
We usually talk about the buy or build, and I call this the assemble model. So, I mean, the state ultimately was the one designing the program, but, for example, the state did not hire nurses, the state contracted with the health centers already in the community that had established relationships with the providers. The state contracted with the School of Medicine to help with the evaluation and the design of some of the intervention components.
Well, I want to move on to some email questions, and we've been getting quite a bit over the last couple days. And I want to start, we've been talking about some of the subgroups or populations where gaps may exist. And we had a number of questions about some of these groups, particularly racial and ethnic minorities. And Helen, you do treat racial and ethnic minorities in a public clinic as a side job. Here's a question from D.C. Racial and ethnic minorities tend to receive a lower quality of health care than more advantaged groups, even when controlling for differences in health insurance. How can states reduce health care quality disparities faced by minorities who represent a growing share of the population in many states? And just talk specifically about some of what you've seen in both your role as a researcher and a policymaker, and mm-hmm. as well as a caregiver. What are some specific steps we could take to mitigate disparities?
There's a lot to be done, that's for sure. I think one of the stumbling blocks is that we rarely measure our quality measures by population. So, in fact, probably the biggest obstacle at this point is we rarely, in fact, can see the data broken down by population. And I think that's at every level of the system. At a state, I think it's probably fairly uncommon to stratify data by race and ethnic groups, as well as language and literacy, some of the other key issues that drive healthcare disparities, and also within a system as well. And also, I think the issue is, I think for a given provider, I take care of exclusively Latinos in my practice who only speak Spanish, so I see a fairly homogenous population. But I think for many providers, they've never seen their own care statistics broken down by population. I think we inherently, as care providers, assume we're doing a good job for everyone. And I think the first step would clearly be we need to give people the information back in a way that allows them to look at that. And actually, an effort we're doing within the National Quality Forum right now as part of a very large project on ambulatory care is coming up with some principles for what are disparity-sensitive conditions. What are the conditions you want to make sure you're at least stratifying by so you can begin to understand where those disparities exist? And I think the only way to really drive improvement oftentimes is to see the data broken down by population and then develop the targeted initiatives that can help reduce disparities for that population. Oftentimes for my clinic patients, it's about language access. It's not about some other issues and disparities, or it's about lack of insurance. So there's issues that really come down to you can drive improvement by really understanding where the issues are. But more than anything else, I would argue that until we systematically measure disparities and think about disparities through the lens of quality, it shouldn't be another topic over here. It has to increasingly become one that's integrated, and whenever we think quality, at the same time we stratify and begin to understand how our system, which doesn't work well for everyone to start with, really begins to fail when you get to some vulnerable populations.
What about resources at the provider level? I mean, you work in a clinic. As difficult as this is for a big hospital, mm-hmm. What are some of the gaps in resources or capacity that a clinic has to even, imagine embarking on a quality improvement endeavor?
Well, I think first of all, oftentimes don't even know their own data. I think that's just getting back to that point. But I think secondly, oftentimes the resources are costly. So, for example, there aren't best practices on exactly how to best use interpreters in the most cost-effective manner. Depending on where you practice, you could have 15 different languages walking into your hospital. So how do you manage that? Some wonderful work actually funded by Commonwealth Fund and ARC and others, beginning to look in terms of the research of saying, what are the most cost-effective strategies that work well for providers, work well for patients, and can begin driving at least the language access. The other reasons for disparities really begin, I think, helping us understand what is cultural competency. It's been a term we've tossed around for a long time, and there are precious few measures that actually could help us understand what they are. So we're actually hoping to embark on a project very soon that would begin to create a framework for cultural competency, begin to learn from the community that's out there what are those best practices, and how does that ultimately then flow into a set of measures people can use to start looking at these issues.
Larry, we've done we've just given prizes to plans that did things to eliminate some of these disparities. And I think the answer is that there are things you can do at the patient end of things, really understanding and being very discerning about patients. There are population subgroups that have belief systems about care that may be counter to the goals in quality. And until you uncover those and really can engage them and convince them that this is really the best way to look at it, you can't really do much. And on the provider side as well, there are kind of mythologies about women don't need to be treated as aggressively if they have high cholesterol as men, for example, is one of the things that's come up. So it really is about getting to understand what's going on and then breaking through, I think, some of these misconceptions.
And what about the state issue? I mean, we've talked about the inability to look at subpopulations. Is that what kind of things have you all done to try?
Well, actually, we just had a briefing last week on a study that we did, which looked at disparities in chronic care, and we had 41 plans in the study. And we found that there were, we see this over and over again, the hierarchy was white men got the best care, black men got the second best, white women got the third best, and black women got the fourth best. And there was a 21-point difference on treatment to goal for women with cardiovascular disease on lipids. And that was on the average was 60%. So, I mean, it's huge. In some of the other areas, we didn't find disparities, though. So with diabetes care, the treatment was actually pretty good. So I think we still have a lot to learn about what exactly the issues are, so we don't want to ready, fire, aim either. So.
Yes.
We just got in another question about, and Melanie, let me start with you. You talked a lot about sort of, and Dr. Wood as well, about focusing on specific conditions, people with specific chronic illnesses, and what you can do there. And this question asks about the effectiveness of condition-specific quality improvement strategies, for example, care for asthma, diabetes, congestive heart failure, versus more generic quality improvement strategies, for example, a medical home, a chronic care model. And in your experience looking at states and your experience developing the program in Indiana, how much of this is condition specific? How much do you really have to dig into a specific condition, and how much can you put in place structures that may improve quality across the board?
Certainly for the highest risk Medicaid patients, the condition specific disease management is nice, but not enough. I mean, it is the complexity of conditions and the interplay of the comorbidities and the impact that has on the ability to improve quality doesn't lend itself well to a condition-specific approach. And that's where the measurement becomes so important. I mean, if you have someone who's diabetic with heart problems, who's depressed, and who's in a wheelchair, it's really probably not the most important thing to know what his hemoglobin A1C is. It's more important to figure out how are we going to get a sense of his ability to interact with the healthcare system and our ability to deliver the three most important things he needs to keep him out of the hospital and to keep him in the most effective care setting. And so, in short, what I think what we've seen from states is a definite evolution from very, very single disease, single vendor, and a whole bunch of them in one state, to movement to managing multiple conditions. But still, I guess someone used the phrase that your disease is your ticket in. And oftentimes when Medicaid starts its identification process, it's doing it based on claims, where it's mining based on a diagnosis. And then, but the evolution today is you see states becoming smarter about the ability to identify and prioritize their patients in a non-condition specific way, because they're able to look across the spectrum of needs. And most importantly, they're able to take not just the administrative claims data that's driven by diagnosis, but look at functional assessment, behavioral health indicators, demographic indicators that predictive, a whole bunch of predictors that help get a sense of the patient as a whole and tailor interventions around that patient's needs, and a much greater sophistication about developing interventions, person population interventions geared at subpopulations. So recognizing that Medicaid beneficiaries with developmental disabilities need a different type of intervention and a different measurement set than the people that have serious persistent mental illness, than the frail elders. And so you start, I think if we're seeing any kind of segmentation at all, it's by type of patient and trying to understand what pattern of conditions seem to be prevalent within these patient types, as opposed to managing by single conditions.
And what's your sense of where states are in terms of their capacity to look at their claims data, look at functional assessments, then be able to tailor improvement programs?
Well, I've often been called a statist, and so I'm a firm believer that states have the capacity, they're using the capacity, they're starting to recognize their ability to leverage their purchasing power. And, you know, I'll say, though, it's not that they're not driven by the need to use quality improvement as a way to control cost. Almost every governor is launching an expansion, you know, wanting to expand coverage. Medicaid gets it that the governor's ability to expand coverage is tied to Medicaid's ability to control cost for its population. And so they have to begin to get smarter about identifying and developing tailored interventions, because it's not just Medicaid anymore. It's tied to so many other things going on in the system, which is a good thing. It just further reinforces, I think, the state's purchasing power, especially when you see states getting aggressive about looking at Medicaid and expecting to use the same types of structures for Medicaid, for state employees, for commercial, the large commercial players in the state. And there are actually places where Medicaid is the lead at bringing other purchasers, whether it's state employers or large commercial plans. The Center for Healthcare Strategies is working with Arkansas, Rhode Island, New York, North Carolina, where Medicaid is leading a system-wide quality improvement effort. And I know that's going on in Minnesota and other places as well.
And Doug Wood, how significant was the purchasing leverage of the state in getting Q-Care going in Minnesota, there in the state?
Well, it's actually very important. I think Melanie has eloquently described why you need a combination of strategies. And as we look at the future, although we have so far focused on specific conditions, we have a construct of the future that says that we would try to apply payment policy and efforts at improvement that would be aimed at the concept of a medical home, where we would try to make sure that patients and physicians work together, providing a base payment for that, and then overlaying on that payments for performance, as well as payments for physicians who were willing to take on additional coordination tasks, which you can't measure reliably with our current systems, but hopefully in a way that we could develop some measurement schemes with the resources we have and improve our performance. So we think it's going to take a combination of both, and the state actually is the lead, just as Melanie has described. It works very well.
Could I just add one point? I think we haven't really touched on the issue of health IT yet, but I think health information technology really becomes often the mechanism to begin sharing data across sites of care, which is really where for so many patients that falls down. And I think states can play a critical role in this. Some of these new value exchanges, for example, that the Secretary has been putting forward, some of the work on aligning forces from the Rob Wood Johnson Foundation, really beginning to have communities come together at the state level or smaller level communities, sharing data, thinking about how IT can bring that information in a different way that begins to help with coordination of care and understanding measurement as well. EHRs can be electronic health records, and health information exchange can be very powerful tools to drive quality improvement by getting quality measures in real time and sharing them.
And how optimistic are you that we're making progress?
She's a statist. I'm an optimist. I think we're making some progress. I think we're starting to see a willingness on the part of electronic health record vendors, for example, to think about how they embed quality within them. I think there is a bit of a tipping point that people are now not saying it's something I don't think I'll do, but trying to figure out exactly when they'll do it. Some surveys we had done when I was at the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality suggested that, in fact, even those who said they weren't ready to adopt were planning in the next 2 to 3 years. So I think we're going to get there. Whether we'll get to interoperability within that time, allowing systems to talk to each other, is hopefully something that some of the additional work that is being done on health IT standards and certification will ultimately help push this forward.
Okay. Is that all right?
Absolutely.
I just like to go back to the point about all the different levers that the states have. I mean, governors really and the, you know, all the state infrastructure need to have a common strategy, which I would call a value strategy. But I think the piece that I think we shouldn't neglect is the public health piece. Mm-hmm. And thinking about, particularly about childhood obesity, which we all know is just a terrible problem. And I think about Arkansas, which really has kind of blazed a trail mm-hmm. in terms of their leadership and their real canniness about aligning the state health insurance program and the Medicaid program and SCHIP and even programs in the schools. I mean, they've just thought of everything. So I think in that way, and also working with businesses, which are also mm-hmm. concerned about it, mm-hmm. they can move the ball in incredible ways that I think some of us look on with great admiration.
Well, and in some sense, you're talking about a much broader definition of quality there than
well,
the care
to me, I think we tend to be a little narrow sometimes in our thinking right. about quality. I mean, I think if you think of healthcare, the purpose of healthcare is to improve health. And so whatever it takes, and that doesn't mean we should medicalize every issue, but I think we in healthcare can kind of create a framework and then get everybody that really cares about it, which is most of our society, kind of moving in the right direction. So there's a leadership role that healthcare can play, even when it's not the direct agent.
And do you see, I mean, historically, there hasn't been a great deal of, or maybe not as much coordination as one would like, between the health financing, health insurance community and the public health community.
Oh, I think there's plenty of opportunity for improvement there.
Well, I want to come back to some of the measurement issues. Until we have the holy grail of a interoperable electronic medical record system, I mean, you rely for your measurement on surveys, on collecting information from providers, from health plans, from patients. And we have a question from Oregon about the whether participation in a program like that, and in the case of Oregon, it's a system for reporting medical errors, should be voluntary versus mandatory, and what are some of the problems with a voluntary system? You don't have the force of government as NCQA.
We don't, but we actually really appreciate the leverage that we get from regulators, for example, in the Medicare program. So our accreditation program is recognized and deemed by states, 38 states, and Medicaid programs, and by the Medicare program. So people, I mean, I think voluntary, if it doesn't have something pushing it, it's not going to go very far. So I actually, for some things, I think for patient safety, the reporting should be mandatory. And I even think there should be auditing, for example, of hospital infection rates. I really do. If there's such an urgency to act on this. And having the data, I mean, as Pennsylvania demonstrated with their kind of relentless pursuit of the data, I think everyone in Pennsylvania takes that issue seriously now.
And do you have are there gaps in your measurement now? I mean, are there
There are more gaps than there are areas that we well understand. And part of the problem is we're mining claims data and then we're going into medical records, which is a very expensive and tedious process. So we're all kind of waiting for, you know, actually some of the leading organizations that have electronic health records are now starting to talk to us and to NQF about how to produce this data more efficiently and effectively. But at the end of the day, I think it really is the ability for the providers themselves to have the data at the point of care that's most important. And at the, I don't know, at the end of it, how many measures we're going to need once we've got the systems really robust and working.
And Doug Wood, I mean, you are a physician. What's been the reaction of providers in Minnesota to the QCARE initiative?
Well, so far the providers have not had any major concerns about the fact that we're going to ask for reporting and that we have an expectation of improvement. And I would say the reason for that is because we've been on this journey for a while. The greatest discussion we're having right now is trying to figure out how we can make everything work most efficiently so that where the QIO is doing something and Community Measurement Project is doing something, that we don't make these somewhat antithetical. And then the other major concern right now actually is how do you do this in patients with multiple comorbidities? So one of the other problems of single condition measures, and I think Melanie began to probe the difficulty here is, sure, you can say that you've got a set of measures for a diabetic patient, and there's a set of measures for a patient with coronary disease. They often overlap. It becomes then difficult sometimes to trade things off because there are situations clinically where you may have to make a decision, I need to work more on one condition than on the other, or one aspect of one than the other, and I'm willing for the time being, I'm willing to work less or accept a lesser result on one of the other measures. And the risk in the measurement is then, especially when you're using composite measures or optimal measures where you say you have to hit every one of them, that becomes a potential penalty for the provider. So that's a topic that we're going to discuss this summer with the QIO in Minnesota and with providers in a symposium that we plan to hold to talk about these kinds of issues to see how we can move forward in a constructive fashion.
Well, I want to kind of, I mean, we've been talking a lot about people with chronic illnesses, serious illnesses, high cost cases, and we have a question from California where he asks, in the context of state-run public programs, particularly Medicaid, performance measurement is traditionally focused on children and their adult parents. And those are the groups that are traditionally been enrolled in managed care plans in particular. What are states and other organizations doing to measure and report quality and consumer satisfaction for seniors and people with disabilities? And Peggy, let me start with you. I mean, are there specific things NCQA has done to reach those
we've
groups?
We've been very lucky. We have a contract with CMS to there are these new plans called special needs plans that are working with the institutionalized elderly and dual eligibles and the people with chronic illnesses. So we are actually focusing now on how do we measure their care. And I think it's a pretty different approach. I don't think we're talking about compliance with guidelines. I think it's much more focused on, you know, how many transitions are going on. Are they in and out of the hospital? I mean, for an institutionalized population, that's a measure of disquality in its own right. Functional status and so forth. So it's taking us into kind of new domains that are very, very important. And I think for the seriously and persistently mentally ill, we really have a very inadequate set of measures, and we need to move forward on that.
And would you say in the context of Medicaid programs where many people with disabilities or seniors are not in managed care plans, does that help the effort?
Well, I think that, I mean, it's always frustrating because you can't do it all at once. And once you've seen what needs to be done, you really have to try to be strategic about what you can do in a given period of time. But I think, you know, we now have, you know, NQF is really vigorous and we have a lot of company, I think, in the quality space. And so it's up to us, I think, to some degree to really align ourselves and create a lot of synergy because there's so much work to be done, you know, so.
And Melanie, in your program was focused on chronic disease management. I mean, were most of these folks, did you find they were in fee-for-service Medicaid? Were they in private plans? In Indiana?
In Indiana, it was all fee-for-service.
Uh-huh.
It's part of the problem. Uh-huh. Big part of the problem. The good thing is, you even in that period of time, right now, so many states are looking at moving into managed care systems. And managed care these days doesn't necessarily mean fully capitated. And I'd say the reason they're able to do that is because there are very strong health plan partners out there that want to work with states and that are understanding better how to care for special needs populations. There's, and so the partnership of the states and the plans working together is also going to move the measurement needle. But it, I mean, it is great to hear that there are things going on, and I'd be curious to know what a reasonable time frame is for developing some of the measurement sets, both within NQF and NCQA. Not that I'm allowed to ask questions.
Oh, you can. Are we close? You think we're close?
Well, I think we're mapping it, and we expect to have some measures by the end of this year. But I think some of the populations, like the mentally ill, I think we could have it done in not very long if we had the funding and the resources, you know. So I feel like that's a group that really just is constantly left behind. So.
I think the one good news side of this is that there's actually been incredible engagement on the part of the clinician community and others to both develop measures, think about how to use them. It's really a cultural change out there that I think helps with this. So as we are increasingly getting measures sent to us to go through our endorsement process, it's great to see that energy on the sort of proximal end of this. And I think the more we get the measures in, I think the faster we can be. We're convening some work actually next month specifically on trying to think about how we add the measures around care coordination to the framework that we came out with last summer. I think we can do this work fairly quickly as long as there's folks really engaged in trying to think through those measures and what they need to look like.
And do you have a sense, I mean, is there a point where this becomes too much of a burden on providers to deal with all these systems?
I think that's what's, you know, I think Peggy and I have both talked about this concept of really needing some national priority setting, national framework. We've got to be able to say, these are the high priority conditions, this is the best way to measure them, and not only that, this is how you deal with patients with the multiple chronic conditions. I saw no one this morning with a condition in my practice. Mm-hmm. It doesn't exist. It's such a rarity. And then also, how do you deal with those issues that people often talk about in the white space between providers? Right. And I think that's really where we need to better understand issues like the effect of the medical home. How do you measure medical homeness? Some work I know NCQA is doing in this area, and understanding what are the right measures to begin getting at those issues of care coordination and where people are falling through the cracks. Half my clinic this morning was spent calling to find out results of tests of things that I should have had sent to me automatically, and yet it's always a struggle to connect those dots. Mm-hmm. The more we have the measurement systems to help understand where those systems are falling down, we'll have better targeted initiatives around improvement.
You talked about a national framework. I mean, could this happen at the state level as well?
It absolutely could. I mean, the states have been incredible drivers here, and I think that the energy we've seen through the work that we did at ARC with the NGA and their state initiatives is exciting. But I think the states also want some directions. I think they want to be able to compare themselves. Mm-hmm. I think that the last thing we want to do is get into a situation where we have 50 different measurement systems that no one can compare. I mean, there's some wonderful initiatives in one state. You can't really compare how well they're doing to another state because they're using different measures and different strategies. So there's so much work to be done on the strategies that I would hope we could at least help understanding this framework, the priorities, and a common set of metrics that we can all begin to use.
And that's what Stephanie's organization does, and the National Governors I mean, there are resources out there so the states can learn from each other.
Absolutely.
And so that we can learn from the states. I think we tend to have a little hierarchical point of view sometimes in Washington that we know everything and we're going to teach the states. So I just really appreciate when they're way ahead of us, like as they always are in Minnesota and a few other states that I can think of for a
they're
number of
issues.
They're
always above average, right?
Yeah. Melanie, do you have a sense, I mean, as someone who works with states quite a bit, I mean, a sense of what states would, what kind of help either the federal government or national organizations like NCQA or NQF could provide, or Center for Healthcare Strategies, to states to make this job easier? or to get out of the way?
Well, we've hit, I mean, as far as the couple of the areas that are really in need of measurement, care transitions, care coordination, the notion of a medical home, how to make sure it's an accountable medical home mm-hmm. is important. So on population basis, trying to understand how to truly measure someone with comorbidities and measure those things that are important to those patterns of comorbidities. From a purchaser perspective, I mean, we have measurement sets with health plans. Many states are putting together pretty sophisticated state-run infrastructures. We call them primary care case management or enhanced primary care case management. And we need some HEDIS-like measurement development in that to begin to recognize that the purchasing world looks different today. And how do we make sure that Medicaid purchasers have ways of measuring their value in the different types of financing structures that are available? And so I'll put a plug in for the HEDIS-like measurement development as well as the population-based measurement development. And to also just close with emphasizing what Peggy said about the special needs plans. And that is a lever that hopefully will be used to try to understand how to better get measures tailored to subsets of very high needs, very heterogeneous populations. And that has to happen. I mean, there's a national impetus to understanding, is care getting better through these special needs plans? And it's tied into a lot of public scrutiny around Medicare. So hopefully that will really help drive that forward pretty quickly. I think what states, the challenge for states is they want things now, and right. it takes a while to test measures, right. and especially for more complex populations, and trying to understand how long is it going to take to get right. there, and what can we have as intermediate or proxy measures along the way.
It's actually wonderful to have this much pressure in a way. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, I've been in this field long enough to remember when everybody thought we had the best quality in the world, and then we went through a point where it was, well, we can't afford better quality because quality always costs more money, and now we know that there's an awful lot of waste in the system, and that we, if we redirect that, we can have our cake and eat it too. So it's actually wonderful. It creates a lot of pressure, but it's great to have everybody understand the great opportunity that exists.
Do you think the case that improving quality doesn't have to cost more, and in fact might cost less, has been made compellingly? Or
I don't know. I've spent all my time doing. Yeah. If you look at my speeches, that's my message. It's obviously not that simple, but it's very clear that there's an awful lot of waste and harm out there that's costing us a fortune. And I think we have an ethical imperative to go after that stuff first.
And there's actually an increasing amount of work being done as well to understand how quality looks across an episode of care. It's really only when you begin to understand a full episode across the patient's illness that you can begin to see where those points are in fact being fairly inefficient, and where there's duplication because point A didn't know what point B was doing. And that's where I think we could start getting at both some of the appropriateness, mm-hmm. some issues of efficiency. And we've got a pilot initiative focused on that right now, trying to understand what are the right efficiency measures and measures that flow across an episode, which I think would really be useful to states who don't look at things from a single provider basis. They have to look at a population level.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about efficiency, what's the outcome of that? Is it the health, a measurement of the health of the patient for a given input of resources, or is it
still appear pretty much some significant controversy yeah. about that? But I think that the bottom line is that the concepts of quality and cost somehow get married, and that you begin to understand what you're buying for your dollar. Are you getting good care for what's happening? And really trying to extract waste. There's just a remarkable amount of waste in our healthcare system, and I don't even think we necessarily know where to find it sometimes. And hopefully initiatives like that will help us get closer.
I like your definition of efficiency, though. I think the amount of health that we get for the healthcare dollar is really the way to look at it.
That'd be a great idea on where we could find waste. I think if we started looking at the dual eligibles, we haven't talked much about, if you look at the amount of money being spent by Medicaid and Medicare, so there's 7 million dual eligibles, and we spend 42% of Medicaid resources and 24% of Medicare resources. We don't talk to each other, so you know that
yes.
there's duplication, there's inefficiency,
absolutely.
There's unsafe care, there's not appropriate care. And so even if we could just put those two data sets
yep.
together and begin to look at from the big government purchaser, where could we be using resources more effectively, that would be a great place to start.
And where's the barrier there to doing that?
Well, I'll tell you one way place there's a barrier is that I pay for this and you pay for that. So I was talking to a Medicaid director, and I said, I was talking about my mother, who is actually dual eligible. She, you know, she's bent down. She's been in a nursing home for a long time. And I was talking about some of the ways in which money gets wasted, and she said, well, that's all Medicare money. That's not my problem. And, you know, and she does have a big budget problem, so I'm not criticizing anybody. But this idea that I worry about my pot of money and you worry about yours and make sure you don't try to pass any cost to me, I think is a big impediment. And I wonder if there's some way to kind of pool those funds or something.
It certainly goes on both sides. I mean, for example, going back to the Indiana program, the investment in the folks with congestive heart failure, close to half of those were on Medicare. So that savings from those reducing those inpatient admissions went to Medicare. And so we absolutely shouldn't look at it that way. I think we see a lot of demonstration projects on the Medicare side of the house for gain sharing. It would be great if we could look at gain sharing for Medicaid and Medicare together. So following a similar structure that's already been, people in Congress are comfortable, people at CMS are comfortable, just adding Medicaid into the mix offers such great potential. Not to mention that the folks who are dual eligibles aren't getting good care. And so opportunity to do both. I think there is a great business case to be made.
Absolutely.
That improving quality there can reduce cost in the short and long term. Mm-hmm. And you have states that are wanting to do this. So, and I think the federal government at most times wants to do it. So trying to get that a high priority is a great opportunity. Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to bring this back up. We're coming to the end of the hour. I want to bring this back up to maybe 30,000 feet. We're at the beginning, or it doesn't necessarily feel like the beginning, of a presidential election. Just yesterday, Senator Clinton announced a platform to reduce costs and improve quality. And just want to ask you all, if you had a presidential candidate's ear, what would you tell him or her was the single most important thing to do in improving quality? And Doug Wood, you're out there in the middle of the country. Let me start with you.
I would say remove the barriers to letting physicians and patients understand what is the best care and letting them get that care. That means making good communication possible, eliminating financial barriers for patients to access care when and where, and also if it means that if we can serve different groups by non-traditional methods, like not in the office, not in the clinic, but at home or in different neighborhood settings that are not paid for fee-for-service, do it.
Helen, you're up.
Oh, boy. That's a long list. Certainly, I think the points Doug has made about eliminating some of those financial barriers are critical, and it's oftentimes difficult to see how you can really make much progress when we continue to have folks who can't really get access to good quality care. I would say the other piece is, I think, increasingly thinking very quality-centric here, since that's the topic for today, would be really recognizing that healthcare quality is a public good, and we need to think about it that way and invest in it in a way that allows us to get the national framework that we need, the national set of metrics, and really think about it as a systems issue. I mean, we really are just not going to make progress by looking at individual level measures without beginning to see how it flows from states to providers and everywhere in between. John Eisenberg, who used to run the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, my old mentor who passed away a few years ago, liked to make the case that healthcare is a team sport. We need to start acting like it. And I think they can have a really important role there.
I always resist the single solution. First of all, I want to say I think we should cover everybody. But the one thing I think is to reform the payment system. So if you can't do things like have email visits or phone visits, and if you can't optimize efficiency without losing money, you're really not going to be very motivated to do it. And
is that something Medicare can drive?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But not only Medicare. I mean, I know that there are others out there that are talking about payment reform, like some of the business coalitions. So I think we really need to realize that everything else is really going to not move forward optimally until we take that on.
Well, I have to say something about Medicaid, right? So I guess I would say support Medicaid's leadership in trying to use quality improvement to improve the system and control cost. And by that, I mean every place else in the healthcare world, quality improvement, when you look to how to improve a system, you talk about quality, HIT, improving payments. In Medicaid, we still, tend to talk about cuts. And you see Medicaid trying to show leadership and demonstrating the value of Medicaid, and we need policies and financing that are going to support the upfront investment it takes to let Medicaid also use improving quality as a solution.
And does that take money, or does that take political will, or both?
It takes money in the short term, but being creative about how we share in the cost and recognizing that we might get cost effectiveness or budget neutrality over a longer time period, supporting demonstrations on Medicaid like we do. I mean, you have providers out there, you have Medicaid agencies, they want to invest in HIT, they want to do measures, they want to do this. They have to spend the dollar to get the dollar. So kind of amortizing some cost over time and recognizing it may take 3 or 5 years, but it's going to happen, and we're going to do it because we've seen it in Medicare and in commercial employers, and we're going to finally start to recognize we need to do it in Medicaid too.
Well, thanks for your willingness to come up with single solutions, as resistant as you might have been. And thanks to our panel of experts, and thanks to you for joining us. I'm Larry Levitt, and you've been watching KaiserNetwork.org. We'll see you next time for Elements of State Health Reform.